You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of eastern Iowa and northwestern Illinois. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and our listeners are in for a real treat these next 2 weeks as I take a look at the two most consequential United States senators from this century, and who knows, probably in history as well. They are Republican Mitch McConnell and Democrat Harry Reid, and I'll examine them through the lens of two authors who wrote books about these two senators. Next week, my guest is John Ralston, who will talk about his book, The Game Changer, How Harry Reid Remade the Rules and Showed Democrats How to Fight. My guest today is Michael Tackett, author of The Price of Power, How Mitch McConnell Mastered the Senate, Changed America, and Lost His Party. If his name sounds familiar, and it did to me, it's because Michael was a political reporter for the Chicago Tribune for many years, and I've read his work. He's also been at the New York Times, Bloomberg, and U.S. News, and is now Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press. And he's a fellow Midwesterner hailing from Anderson, Indiana. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Oh, glad to be with you. Thank you.
I'm just really interested in Mitch McConnell based on what you've written. I mean, most people, I think, if you were to ask a one-word association, would say the Supreme Court, obstructionists, of course, his opponents would say. But what comes through is the word that's in the title of the book, power. He pursued power and wielded power. Some have compared him to LBJ. How did this start? How did this intense focus on power and his ability to use power, where did that start with? How did that get its start in his life?
Well, he was certainly not an overnight success. He always wanted to be in politics. And he started out wanting to be an athlete. But as a child, he had polio. And eventually, the after effects of polio meant that he wasn't going to be an athlete. So he channeled all that kind of competitiveness into politics. And he was interested in it at such a young age. He knew he wanted to run for class president when he was a sophomore in high school. And so he started to build support then for an election that was going to be 2 years out. He did the same thing when he was in college. He used to carry around a business card that said Senator Mitch McConnell as a student at the University of Louisville. So he was studying power from a very young age. Then he had some internships on Capitol Hill, and he got really exposed to power in a big way. And he just saw his future there, as improbable as that was. And he continued to pursue it.
Yeah, as you note in the book, he didn't come from wealth. He's from a middle-class family, similar to Harry Reid. Harry Reid grew up in a very poor working-class family. But he didn't have a major name, but yet he was able to still, just through some very persistent and hardworking characteristics, to get where he wanted to be. I think you talk about here, the interesting part about him is a son of the South was his views on race growing up, which surprised me.
Yeah, he really had a very forward-looking view on race relations, and I think he attributes a lot of that to his father. His father served in World War II, and he saw, that there were black soldiers fighting right there with white soldiers, and that everybody was sort of the same in that regard. And he kind of tried to, infuse that into his son's thinking. And it played out really that way through most of his life. When he was in college, he participated in civil rights demonstrations and marches. So it meant something to him. Then when he was in the Congress as an intern, he watched as sort of the civil rights bills were approaching. But what was interesting was in the 1964 campaign, he was a Goldwater supporter because he was a conservative from day one. And then Goldwater came out against the civil rights legislation, and Mitch McConnell voted for LBJ, which may be the only time, or one of the very few times, I don't know about the recent elections, but one of the very few times that he ever voted for a Democrat for president. And he stayed pretty consistent with that throughout his time. Now, he would not have what a civil rights advocate today would call a progressive record. He sort of stopped at Equal opportunity, yes. Special preference, no.
One interesting part of his experience in Washington, you talk about in those early years, was he was there for some controversial Supreme Court appointments, which, of course, we'll get to the later role he had in forming the Supreme Court, which is what he's most known for. But talk a little bit about those. I didn't realize, you know, that he had some knowledge and was there when those occurred, and what impact they may have had on his future views of the court.
Yeah, so this was the Haynesworth and Carswell nominations, two nominations for the Supreme Court that went south. And he was involved as a staff member on that, preparing Marlo Cook, the senator, for those confirmation hearings and how he might vote. So he really understood the process from a very early age. And a lot of people don't realize that he had that sort of foundational experience for how that would work. And then fast forward to when he's in the Senate himself, and he's there at a time when the Robert Bork nomination is being heard. And of course, Bork's nomination failed, and he saw how those politics worked. And then he was there for the Clarence Thomas hearings, and we all remember, or many of us remember, how contentious those were. So he was sort of battle-hardened on the Supreme Court early on. And then when he himself had the power to try to determine what would happen, he used all of his power to steer the court in a rightward direction.
Yeah, let's get right into that. I mean, the book was a useful reminder of the timing of things that happened in his approach to the court. I go back to when Justice Scalia passed away. That was in February of 2016, a full, 10 months before the election. Everybody remembers this. How did he approach this? He wasn't in Washington, which is interesting, that whole story. How you talk about this, I'll let you talk about it, or the readers can buy a book, which would be the better option. But how did he I mean, he developed an entire strategy, like a war room, about this appointment, which was fascinating to me. What was his approach on the Scalia passing and the circumstances involved, and the actions he took when Obama was president?
So the war room was his hotel room in the Caribbean, and his war council was basically himself. He and his wife had gone, Elaine Chao had gone on vacation, as they often did during the President's Day recess. And they landed, and he has a message that Scalia has passed away. So he immediately goes to the hotel room and starts to fashion his strategy. And within an hour or so, he's talked to his staff, and he said, "We have to get a statement out right away that says we will not have a vote on this." And the rationale that he came up with was another exercise in just sort of brute force power. His rationale was that if the president and the majority of the Senate were of opposite parties, then you wouldn't advance a Supreme Court nomination in an election year. Now, of course, there's no Senate rule that says that. There's no Senate norm that says that. He just did that because he could. He had the numbers, and even though some of his members on the Republican side were against it, he was able to ram that through, and he was able to stop Barack Obama from replacing Scalia.
Not even meet with or allow a hearing or any type of activity. And it involved, I guess, his friend, you could call it, Joe Biden, and some history of comments that Biden had made about similar type situations.
Yeah, this is one of the things. This is sort of the part of the book, you know, The Price of Power, is about kind of the inside story of the inside game of politics. And honestly, sometimes when you get closer to the inside, it doesn't look any better. And
yeah.
sometimes it looks
yeah.
worse.
Yeah.
So they came up with this idea that there was a Biden rule, that Joe Biden, when he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, had said that, you know, maybe we shouldn't consider a nominee for the court if the Senate was controlled by one party and the White House was controlled by another. So it's important to note that there was no Biden rule. Biden had said that sort of offhandedly and never acted upon it. But the way the politics of it worked, they used that as part of a rule. They used some comments that Chuck Schumer had made in the early 2000s all to sort of fashion the argument, which was basically boiled down to, if the shoe was on the other foot, they'd do the same thing to us. He got away with it. And as a result, it enabled President Donald Trump to have three Supreme Court nominees.
And then, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passes away. I looked that date up as well. That was September 18th of 2020. That's less than 2 months before an election. But he was a Senate majority leader, and Trump was president. What was his approach this time?
To ram it through as fast as humanly possible. In fairness, his argument was, well, this was a different situation because the Senate was controlled by the same party as the president. I'm not sure a lot of people would necessarily square that circle and look at it that way, but that's how he looked at it. And again, he got away with it. He got away with it. Why? Because they had the numbers, and that's what mattered.
That's right. Just an exercise in raw power. And as you mentioned, that's what this book is about. If our listeners are interested in how Washington works behind the scenes, this is just really fascinating, and I think you'll enjoy it. Even if you don't agree with the outcomes, even if you don't like Mitch McConnell, it's really interesting inside take on how our government really works. Talk a little bit about, if you would, Michael, going back, because I think this is important for our listeners as well. How this started, I mean, it's like two kids in the backyard. You started it, no, you did, like in a snowball fight. But where did this battle over, especially the use of the filibuster, begin, and how it was used for judicial nominees and outside the scope of how it had been traditionally used?
So the filibuster, statistically, was a fairly limited weapon in the Senate. You know, it was sort of used in famous instances like Strom Thurmond trying to block, civil rights legislation, in the 1940s. It had been used situationally to try to stop certain bad things. Well, so it went from being sort of a nuclear weapon to an everyday part of the arsenal for McConnell. And when Barack Obama was elected, the Republicans were really at sea. They were really worried that not only had Obama won, but that he seemed to be leading what was sometimes called the coalition of the ascendant that was going to consign the Republicans to being in the minority for a very long time. Well, McConnell had to try to rally his troops there. And the way he rallied them was he said, we still have a lot of power. And part of the power we have is to say no. Because in the Senate, unlike the House, it takes 60 votes really to get anything done. And so that's the filibuster. And so McConnell used that in ways that in numbers and in ways that it hadn't been used before, but it was all within the four corners of the strict reading of the rules. So while it was extremely frustrating to Democrats, McConnell's Republicans kind of cheered him because one of the things that underscored is McConnell was always willing to do an unpopular thing. To not worry about his popularity. And if you think about it, the Senate Majority Leader is an office that has a lot of power, obviously, but it's not an office that's in the Constitution. It's not like the Speaker of the House. It's not like cabinet officers. It is a purely political job. So McConnell's constituency in that sense is to have a majority of the Republicans in the Senate on his side. So that's not a real big universe. And I think he was able to use that because he cultivated those people. He made their needs his needs. He worked for their reelections. He raised money for them. He attacked their opponents during campaigns. And he built loyalty that way.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Michael Tackett. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Associated Press, as I said at the introduction. I saw his name on this book, and I thought, is that the same guy that I used to read all the time with the Chicago Tribune? It is. Some of you may remember that. Michael did some outstanding work for the Tribune for a number of years. He's written a book about Mitch McConnell. Part of our listeners out there probably love him. Part of them probably hate him. But this is a fascinating book, again, a behind-the-scenes look at how power is wielded in Washington. And The book is called The Price of Power: How Mitch McConnell Mastered the Senate, Changed America, and Lost His Party. One of the interesting things, and I had forgotten about this as somebody who's followed politics my whole life, but his views on campaign finance reform. I mean, there again, if you were to ask generally what issue is Mike or Mitch McConnell associated with beyond Supreme Court justices, you'd kind of go, well, really nothing. But campaign finance, I remember him being involved in that. But talk a little bit about how that evolved. And I think it's especially important in how he used finance and fundraising to really establish and add to his power.
Well, sometimes, as the old saying goes, where you stand depends on where you sit. When he was first running for office to be the county judge executive in Louisville, he wrote an op-ed piece for the Louisville Courier-Journal calling for strict campaign finance rules and strict limits on the amounts of contributions. But when you fast forward into his career in Congress, he does exactly the opposite. And it's one thing that it's another example of him being willing to do an unpopular thing. Most incumbents in Congress really don't like the idea of quote unquote campaign finance reform because it's probably not going to help them. They have an inherent advantage by being an incumbent to have a financial advantage, which of course matters a lot in the campaign. And I will say he's been very consistent about this since then. He takes the position that campaign money is speech. And as such, it should be basically subject to only a regulation akin to a free speech argument. And he's been very successful at that. And he's, again, been willing to be sort of the bad guy. In fact, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, who's famous for the McCain-Feingold campaign finance laws, called him Darth Vader and said, yeah, you're the Darth Vader of politics. And McConnell's pretty good at taking a joke, and like he wrote Feingold back and signed the letter Darth Vader. Then you go forward to the Citizens United decision, which people may be familiar with, which for all intents and purposes opened up all avenues of campaign giving for corporations and wealthy people and led to a lot of untraceable so-called dark money. And the Republicans did this, and I think they thought they had really, hit the mother lode, that this was going to be the thing that would enable them to really have an inherent advantage in campaigns. It may have started out that way, but now, if you look at the numbers, it's almost a zero-sum game. Both sides tend to have this. In some cycles, Democrats spend more in dark money than Republicans do. So I'm not sure it quite worked out the way that he intended it to work out. But the overall theme that there should be very few regulations on campaign spending, he definitely won that argument.
It was fascinating to watch him grow and wield power. And his main consideration was maintaining his majority, helping his members. But that didn't just start at the beginning. He kind of learned along the way, especially the role of fundraising and participating in primaries, which I think, again, as it moves on, he starts taking a lot more active role as leader.
So he goes into the Senate. He gets elected in 1984, so he's seated in 1985. And he has a real serious case of imposter syndrome because he's looking around the room and there's Bill Bradley, the famous NBA player, Ted Kennedy, the legend, Bob Dole, the World War II war hero, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the public intellectual. It was a group of very substantial people. And so he knew that if he was going to be successful in the Senate, he needed to be willing to bide his time. And so that's what he did. So his first and second and third obligation after winning a first term was to win a second. And he was able to do that. And after that, he set himself on a path where he kept doing this sort of brick by brick work of advancing within the party. So you take on jobs like the Republican Senate Campaign Committee, and you'd raise money for people. You would be the head of the Rules Committee, so you'd oversee the inauguration. You'd be the dutiful number three, and then the dutiful number two. And then finally, he got his opportunity for the job that he had coveted since the day he walked in.
Yeah, I mean, he was learning not only the rules on how to use amendments you talk about, for example, to get things done, how to block things, but also on the political side. I thought it was interesting how we remember us political junkies remember that cycle when the Republicans, I think it was 2010, nominated some really far out candidates and lost winnable seats. And it was like, he was like, okay, that's not going to happen anymore. And he starts getting involved in primaries. And then he forms the leadership pack, which really, he starts running, basically running a lot of these campaigns, him or his, some of his close advisors.
His leadership pack became this sort of parallel universe. And, you know, McConnell cares about the details of policy. He cares about the politics even more. And so he knew that having this kind of big financial arm would be an augmentation to his power. And so he nurtured that super PAC for years and years. And only when he stepped down as leader did he cede control of that super PAC.
Yeah. It, you know, you mentioned something I flagged and I got to bring up. This is how, and for our listeners, you think about this and you might think just on a basic level, civics 101 level, you come up with your ideas on policy and then you figure out how to advance them. But he almost did it opposite. He looked at the political angle first in order to develop the policy arguments.
There are a lot of senators who measure themselves by bills that carry their name, landmark legislation. That just wasn't what he did. Part of that is because he had most of his power when the Republicans were in the minority for a lot of that time. And so he did have to use that power to stop things. And when he became the majority leader, it's less important to try to advance a personal agenda than to advance the party agenda. And after President Trump was elected in 2016, to try to advance the president's agenda. So that was really where he stood on that. He did not look at legislation as being that critical to his career, except for the kind of legislation that benefited his home state. And by some calculations, he's funneled more than $40 billion to the state of Kentucky. So there's some legislation he's very good at and very committed to.
You mentioned Trump. We've got to talk about his relationship with Donald Trump, and especially, you know, January 6th, the two impeachment votes, and how he, again, how he kind of, it seemed like shifted a little bit, and his reasonings for that.
Well, I mean, they start off, I think he's wary. He doesn't really know what to expect when Trump is elected. And then he comes to talk to him. And I should say that part of my research was I had access to oral histories that Senator McConnell would conduct once a year, sort of a year in review. And he would talk candidly, you know, about what had happened. And in 2018, you could really see vividly that his views on Trump had really hardened, where he called him despicable, not very smart, and he thought he was kind of dangerous in his governing style. Now, those weren't things he talked about publicly, obviously, but that's how he felt in his own heart. He felt like the two things he could do, they didn't have enough of a majority to really do much in legislation, but he could do a lot to get judges, federal judges on the bench. So he worked with some conservatives in the Federalist Society, with Don McGahn, the White House counsel, and they just created a pipeline and they rammed through these federal judges one after another to really try to reshape the federal judiciary. The other major thing was the tax legislation, the first tax bill that he and Paul Ryan, who was then Speaker of the House, they were really the prime movers of that. And they knew that as long as they called it the Trump tax bill to the White House, that things would be fine. And they were. But there was definitely friction there, and it was definitely escalating. And then after January the 6th, I should actually back up, because their split was really the rupture in their relationship was actually before that. So when the Electoral College met in 2020 to ratify Joe Biden's victory in the White House race, McConnell came out and made a statement, said congratulations to the president-elect, you know, and didn't buy into any of this idea that the election was somehow not on the level. Well, Trump got on the phone with him and in a profanity-laced tirade just ripped into it. And for the better part of 2 years, they never even spoke, not even hello. So there was definitely bad, bad blood there. Then you have January the 6th. And after January 6th happens, that's it. McConnell is just can't abide it anymore. And there's an anecdote in the book where his staff told me that they had to shove tables in front of their doors in the office to keep the rioters from breaking through. McConnell, wept when he talked to them because he knew they'd been put in danger simply for doing their jobs. And then he goes on the floor of the Senate and says that Trump is, personally and morally responsible, for what happened. But then you go to the second impeachment vote that you noted. So once again, here's one of the signature traits of McConnell is he is what they call a rational actor. He is like a clinician. He divorces himself from the emotion. He decides what can and can't be done, and then he does it and doesn't do it with a lot of heartfelt feeling. So the way he looked at it was, and this was not clear until the very last minute which way he was going to vote. He did not try to persuade Republicans one way or the other. He kept his own counsel on this, and people really didn't know which way he was going to go. So what he ended up doing was voting against conviction. And the reason he did that was twofold. One, there were midterm elections coming up. Number two, they didn't want to depress the energy of the Trump-based voter to do that. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, a lot of people, that's a very big criticism I've heard since the book's been published. People will read that and they'll go, he could have done more. Why didn't he do this? And I certainly understand where they're coming from. His perspective on that, and again, if you can look at it through the lens of February of 2021 and not 2026, he thought there'd be no way that Trump would make a comeback and that there would be a very high likelihood that the legal system would take care of him. And he considered the impeachment purely a political process. And he thought that there was an indictable, impeachable offense that Trump had committed, but he thought that the legal system would handle that. And then, as of course, we've come to find that's not how it played out.
Well, it's, the story, final story hasn't been told yet on Mitch McConnell and his legacy. He's still in the Senate. He's not leader anymore. But this really takes you through the seminal moments in his career. And if you're looking, again, for a book about a leader, about leadership, about using power, wielding power, this guy is a multidimensional person. And I think Michael, my guest today, just did an outstanding job of covering all angles of the guy. I think you were fair, and I think you were objective, and I think this is an important piece on our country, which covers this enormous change we've had, this realignment in the last 50 years. So, I really like the book, and I recommend it for our listeners. And I really appreciate you taking the time being on today, Michael Tackett, author of The Price of Power, How Mitch McConnell Mastered the Senate, Changed America, and Lost His Party. Thank you so much.
Robin, good to talk to a fellow Midwesterner.
You've been listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.